Yeah, they are.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the PN Pod. I am Aaron Rupar here with my usual co-host, Paul Waldman. We thank all of our lovely viewers and listeners for bearing with us today. We're obviously starting a little bit later than normal as I subjected myself to J.D. Vance's press briefing from the White House press room. It was the first briefing since Carolyn Leavitt left the Post last week. And of course, this came amid rumors today that Maria Bartiromo, who kind of surprisingly, her departure from Fox News was announced today. It's still unclear as we record this what the circumstances of that are, but there's been rumors that maybe she would be next in line for that gig. And J.D. Vance was asked about that, kind of punted the question, which I thought was notable, said he didn't know anything about it. There has been some reporting separately that she is not leaving for a White House position. So it seems like maybe that is not the case. But Paul, do you have any favorite Maria Bartiromo memories?
That sums it up, right?
I mean, you know, she's one of those people who you could almost tell that there was like a reasoning human being somewhere buried deep, deep inside underneath what she it puts on the air every day. I don't know. I mean, you know, it wouldn't surprise me at all. I don't know what the current count of former Fox News personalities who are employed in the Trump administration is, but it's got to be in the dozens by now. Really quite remarkable. And you know, that's what Trump likes is he sees somebody on the TV and he says they should get a job. And sometimes it's for a communication job and that's basically fine. And then sometimes it's for something like Secretary of Defense, and that goes very badly.
Yeah, I mean, he honestly could probably do worse than Maria Bartiromo for that particular role. And, you know, we're a little behind the news with the Carolyn Leavitt thing, which was the subject of a lot of discussion last week. But, you know, obviously, you know, a reprehensible liar in a lot of ways, but was effective at her job in the sense that, you know, I think unlike maybe Sarah Sanders, she was kind of good at like not getting into fights with reporters in a way that I thought oftentimes kind of reflected poorly on the White House during Trump's first term. So, you know, there's kind of significant shoes to fill. And, you know, I guess we'll see if Maria, you know, ends up being the person to fill them. I will note selfishly, the timing's a little unfortunate because one of my favorite monthly rituals is on the first Friday morning of the month when the new jobs report comes out. I used to love watching Maria's show because the real-time reactions to bad jobs reports when Trump is president are always priceless where, you know, sometimes the market will go up because, you know, a poor jobs report will tamp down speculation that maybe the Fed will raise interest rates, which causes stocks to go up. So, you know, she could find a silver lining almost no matter what. And conversely, you know, during Biden, when there'd be really good jobs reports, she could always find, you know, kind of a negative to them, usually surrounding inflation. So it'll be interesting to see how they handle that tomorrow. I'm sure, you know, they'll find someone else to spin that. But at least for me, as someone who watched her show every morning, kind of a bittersweet day because for all of her, you know, the lies and obviously how close she was to all the January 6th stuff where her texts were part of the Dominion litigation, you know, where she actually seemed to be more of a true believer than some of the Fox hosts like Tucker Carlson, who acknowledged in some texts that, you know, he hated Trump and you know, recognized that he was lying. You know, Maria's text actually kind of indicated that she, you know, really believed that the election was stolen from Trump, or at least was indicating that privately. But despite that, you know, she did have a knack for getting significant guests on her show, whether it be people like John Thune or Scott Bessent or Brooke Rollins. That's the reason I watch every morning is because there'd be a lot of newsworthy guests on there. So I hope it doesn't become just kind of another bland Fox Business show, you know, Fox News with a stock ticker, basically like Stuart Varney's show is. But anyway, we didn't really plan to talk about that, but notable circumstances given the J.D. Vance briefing and the speculation going on today. So what we did want to talk about to begin things is have another made-for-TV production, which is the Trumpapalooza event coming up next Wednesday and Thursday. Now, before I turn over to Paul, who wrote about this in his Substack, The Cross Section, this week and talked about how, in some ways, this kind of embodies like the worst possible strategy that Republicans could take heading into the midterms. I think it's good to kind of, you know, for people who haven't followed this, kind of explain what's going on, which is that this is an unusual type of convention. We think of the RNC or the DNC happening every 4 years during presidential cycles. Obviously, we're in a midterm cycle and Republicans are trying to kind of offer, you know, a simulation or something similar to those types of conventions to sort of rally support ahead of midterms, it doesn't seem like it's going to be going very well for Republicans, where they're likely to lose the House and maybe even the Senate as well. Now, Fox is reporting today that only about 2,000 tickets have been distributed for this event next week. And Paul, as you noted in your piece, it also coincides with the first two nights of the NFL season next week. I think there's games on Wednesday and Thursday. So that'll probably tamp down some of the viewership, I would think. And it's another indication that for all of Trump's talk about how he's the sports president, that, you know, he's not actually that tapped into what's going on with sports. But let's turn over to you, Paul. You made the case in your piece this week at the Cross Section that this is kind of the worst of all worlds for Republicans. So tell us to begin with what you meant by that.
Yeah, you know, if you look at the way the regular conventions where they nominate the presidential nominees go, it's actually something that's really valuable for parties. It comes in large part from the fact that they get so much press coverage. They're across all the TV networks, which is less important now than it used to be. But the fact that they were, you know, in the old days when there were three TV networks and you would turn into ABC, NBC, or CBS, and they would all be showing the convention, that was a really important thing for political parties. And there's political science research that shows that they actually do serve boost your party's standing in the election polls, in large part because it's kind of reminding people why they're a member of this team. And so some of your own voters will come home. And it's also, you know, a chance to kind of put your best face forward, have a bunch of speeches and videos about how great you are. I don't think that's going to really be the effect here. First of all, it's not going to be broadcast live on all the networks. I guess C-SPAN will carry it. I don't know. Maybe Fox will.
Yeah, Fox will.
But it's not like everybody is going to see it. And then you have to ask, like, what are they actually going to be doing? Now, one of the points I made is that if you look out at the GOP right now, they don't have a lot of super persuasive figures who are going to be able to really kind of light up the screen, you know? And it's not that Democrats don't have people who are not persuasive either. Like, nobody is like, I can't wait to hear Chuck Schumer's next speech. But Democrats do actually have some people who are pretty compelling. You know, they have the most popular ex-president in America, Barack Obama, who speaks at conventions. You know, they've got people like John Ossoff and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who are like interesting, charismatic figures. If you look out at the Republican candidates this year, you know, there's nobody who you're going to look at them and say, wow, you know, that person is just dynamite. And if we put them on TV for 20 minutes, then they are really going to start winning over some voters. Like, you know, nobody is saying that about Michael Whatley or, you know, John Husted or Mike Rogers. Half the people on this very Substack Live are like, oh, wait, who was that guy again? You know, yeah. Like, they're just not all that exciting. It's a two-night thing. J.D. Vance is speaking on the first night. Trump is speaking on the second night. And there, too, that shows the problem. Like, it's not like J.D. Vance is really, you know, such a compelling presence that he's winning converts left and right. We know this is a problem for him and will be a problem for him when he runs for president. And then you've got Trump, whose approval ratings are now in the 30s. And the thing about the actual content of this convention and what it's likely to be is that it's just going to be about how great Donald Trump is. And there's been some reporting in a number of places that, like, they have had discussions in the White House. How should we go about the home stretch of this election campaign? And basically the decision has been like, we'll just make it about Trump. And that obviously comes from Trump himself. He doesn't want to hear that there's some other message that has nothing to do with him that they're going to send. No, he wants it to be about him. And so he says, I want it to be about me. And they say, all right. And so one of the interesting sidelights of this is Trump's super PAC has raised something like $400 million, a huge amount of money. And all of the Republican candidates who were vulnerable out there, they have been kind of sitting on the edge of their seat saying, you know, when are they going to come and help me in my district? When are they going to drop some of that money on me so that I can fight back this challenge from this Democrat? And they've been waiting and waiting. And Trump hasn't released the money yet, but they just released two new ads that this super PAC is going to run. And what are they about? They're about how great Donald Trump is. And so it's like saying, all right, so you got this unpopular president. Every Democrat is running saying this election is about Donald Trump. And they're going to air a bunch of ads saying this election is about Donald Trump. I don't think that's a great strategy. And even Republican candidates are surfacing. Yeah, I don't know about that. And that's why not very many of them are actually even coming to this thing. As you say, they haven't sold them any tickets. There's something where they're going to charge candidates a huge amount of money just to attend. Mm. And so that's going to keep them away. And it just doesn't, it seemed like an idea that like maybe that might be helpful in some way, but the way it's playing out, it doesn't look like it's going to help them at all.
Yeah. And I should mention, which I neglected to earlier, that the Trumpapalooza thing, that is not like a cute thing that we came up with. That's RNC chair Joe Bruders has been on TV saying this for weeks, if not months, that the event is going to be Trumpapalooza. So it seemed like this has been kind of baked in for a while that this event is going to be all about Trump. And the other thing, Paula, that I'd mention is this week in particular on Fox, it's become like a recurring bit where John Thune was on there yesterday being interviewed and kind of pleading, I think it's called MAGA Inc., the Trump super PAC, to help some of these candidates in the tough Senate races to spend some of their money. And then Comer today was on Fox basically doing the same thing, kind of pleading that, you know, he had this kind of excuse where he said, well, typically super PACs don't really spend until the last 60 days and we're 61 days out. So I think it's still coming. But, you know, there's a lot of speculation out there that Trump is either, you know, going to try to somehow kind of pocket it or use the money for his own purposes. Or like you said, you know, maybe spend it on ads that don't really directly help, you know, some of these candidates. And, you know, of course, the other thing is that, you know, some of the criticisms that you made or the observations of like how there's no charismatic figures in the Republican Party. I think you could have said largely the same thing 2 years ago, you know, when they had their convention in 2024. And, you know, it's probably best remembered the RNC for being right after the Butler assassination attempts. Of course, that was the Trump speech where he had like the diaper on his ear, which is kind of the indelible image from that. You know, but it wasn't like they had a lot of electrifying speakers back then. If you remember, his big headlining speech was widely panned because he kind of started with like some somber remembrances of Butler. And of course, they brought out the uniform of the firefighter who was killed. He was sitting behind Trump at that rally, which was kind of a weird moment. But some people, I think, you know, thought it was you know, kind of poignant or emotional. But then he went into like the same speech that he always does, like the hour long ranting and raving. And I think the whole speech ended up being like 90 minutes long. It was like a Castro length diatribe. And so, you know, it wasn't super well received. And then of course, Republicans went on to win the election anyway. But you know, I think maybe one of the difficulties here is that, you know, they control the entire federal government at this point. And what are you really talking about other than the greatness of Trump? You know, when you look at the accomplishments, I mean, I guess you could talk about kind of securing the border. You can talk about the stock market. But, you know, it seems to me at least like some of this focus on Trump is kind of a compensation for the fact that beyond that, you know, with economic sentiment being really negative, with Trump's numbers being in the toilet, the Iran war obviously being very unpopular, there just isn't a whole lot else to talk about that's going to make Republicans look good other than, you know, these couple data points that I already mentioned and maybe fear-mongering about communism.
Yeah, and one thing I've noticed in the last couple of days especially is that they have basically, I think, decided that the tax cut is really all they have to talk about, the one big, beautiful bill. And if you'll remember, when it passed, it was like the least popular major piece of legislation in history. And you think like, how hard is it to sell a tax cut? People don't like taxes, but it was incredibly unpopular like during the whole time that it was being debated. And now they're coming back and saying like, this is the thing that we did that really has been so spectacular. And you saw that in J.D. Vance's press conference today. He's talking about the tax cut and how terrible it is that the Democrats want to undo it. And basically saying like, this is the reason why everything is going so great in the economy is that we did this tax cut. Now, problem with that is that if people don't think everything is going so great in the economy, then that's not going to be very persuasive to say that it was that the thing that gave you the economy that we have now is this basically the one piece of legislation that of any kind of magnitude that we passed in our first 2 years in office. But I kind of suspect that like they don't have a whole lot, you know? So what else are they going to do? What else are they going to talk about? You know, as you say, they can talk about securing the border. Okay. That's the one thing when you phrase it that way, not about immigration writ large, but just about securing the border. That's the one thing where Trump almost has more people approving than disapproving, although it's really close. Every other issue he's underwater on. But, yeah, you know, they know they have to talk about the economy. Like I think they've clued in now to that they can't just say like let's talk about something else. So they have to communicate to people that they have some kind of sympathy for how people feel and for people's unease about the economy. But the only argument that they can come up with is we passed this tax cut and it was so great and it's doing so many great things. And that's why everything is terrific. But, you know, that can't land if people feel actually that things are not so terrific.
Yeah. And also it's difficult timing given that just, I think it was last week, you know, there were a lot of headlines about the national debt hitting $40 trillion, which is in part a consequence of the huge tax cuts that were in the One Big Beautiful Bill. So, you know, that kind of complicates that messaging. So, you know, another thing that I'm kind of wondering, what do you think, you know, obviously with the Republican Party, they're still kind of deep in the Trump cult at this point where, you know, no one is really objecting to the fact that this is going to be Trumpapalooza. I mean, you did have, I saw someone mentioned in the comments here, kind of an interesting clip from James Comer in the same interview that I mentioned earlier, where he was talking about, you know, basically pleading for MAGA Inc. to spend some money. He was also asked if he was going to be at Trumpapalooza, and he said, no, I had some stuff planned. I'm not going to be there. And he's, you know, obviously kind of a true believer. So if someone like him isn't going to show up, you know, it'll be interesting to kind of do a roll call there. But, you know, do you think this is a situation where once we get through the midterms, you know, maybe Republicans, you know, if there's a result that's really negative, as we kind of expected for Republicans, where they lose the House, possibly the Senate, how do you see the dynamic within the party changing if that election kind of goes the way that we think it will? You know, I guess I could see that there's still going to be a lot of incentives not to speak out against Trump or to have too much distance with him because, you know, of course, there'll be congressional elections coming up right again then in 2028. And, you know, Trump could endorse primary challengers, you know, which he did after January 6th. He kind of leveraged his hold over the base to take out people who had supported impeachment or convicting him. But, you know, I just wonder if we'll look back at this convention as being kind of like one of the last, you know, like a dying moment of the Trump cult ahead of this election that goes really poorly. And that changes a lot of the dynamics that we're kind of used to after a decade of this.
Yeah. You know, if you look right now at some of the coverage, what you'll find is that there are Republicans, maybe some members of Congress, but certainly people who are like, you know, the quote unquote strategists who are saying now that what he's doing for them is not very helpful, but it's anonymous quotes. They haven't yet gotten to the point where they're going to say that and attach their name to it. Now, that may change over time. If it's a big loss in November, then people are going to say, okay, you know, he's the lame duck now. He's going to be out of here in 2 years. What do I do to position myself? But it's complicated, right? Because not only is there still a lot of loyalty to him, if you look around, though, the people, you know, he's had kind of a mixed record on his endorsements. Some of them have really you know, backfired or the people he endorsed just didn't win for one reason or another. And so you can look at that and say, well, you know, it's not a sure thing. You can say that someone like Tom Massey, who made being willing to stand up to Trump really kind of one of the core parts of his political identity, he ended up losing. And so if I was a Republican congressman, I would say, well, I don't want to get too far out front, maybe like some gentle criticism. But then what happens when you get to the 2028 primary campaign and now that guy has to run in a primary? Well, Trump is still the president. He still has all the attention. He's going to be as, you know, vindictive and angry as ever. He is going to be very much wanting to play the kingmaker, not just in the presidential race, but in every race. He's going to want to feel like he's still in control of the party. But yet, anyone who's running in a district that's closer knows that being seen as too close to Trump is going to be a real problem. And so it creates a really complicated situation for a lot of them. There's no clear path to, you know, say like, this is the best thing for me politically. You know, before you could say, well, I need to hug him as close as possible because otherwise I'm dead in the primary. But maybe there are going to be Republican voters who are like, you know, maybe it's time to move on. We had our 10 years with Trump, or it'll be our 12 years with Trump. And now we want something different. But there's still going to be a lot of sort of Trump cultists in the electorate. It's, you know, if you're a Democrat right now, it's really not that complicated. Yeah, there are some issue disagreements, but you have to tell your voters, I'm a fighter and I am going to fight. And most of the people who are doing that are progressives. There are some people, you know, like John Ossoff, who has made that part of his identity, even though he's, yeah, a little more moderate. You don't have to be on the left because it's not really about issues. It's about kind of a feeling, an attitude. So that's pretty easy if you're a Democrat right now to just be like, I'm going to be the guy who fights. Okay, that tells the voters what they want to hear. But a Republican in 2028, what exactly is the thing that is sort of the clear path to success for them? It's going to be really hard. And yeah. That's going to be true of the presidential candidates and candidates lower down too.
Well, it's also very notable to me how, and maybe you've picked up on this too, how even when Trump tries to promote some of these Senate candidates like Ken Paxton, yesterday, two different speeches that he gave, he kind of foregrounds his endorsement with like all of Paxton's negative qualities, where he's like, he doesn't dress well, and he doesn't talk well, and he doesn't interview well, and people don't like him, but he's better than the alternative. You know, and so to me, I come away from a lot of Trump public events kind of struck by how little he seems to give a shit about the midterms. And, you know, which leads me to kind of wondering, like, you know, I don't think he's going to run again in like a traditional sense, but, you know, is there some way in which he wants to kind of keep the presidency really close to him so he can still kind of have leverage over it, whether it be like, you know, Don Jr. Being someone who runs, or, you know, maybe him and Vance, you know, are so close at this point that Vance could kind of fill that like surrogate son role. But it's just, you know, it's kind of baffling. And I guess this isn't really new. I mean, we can think back, like, I think it was January 5th, 2021, the day before January 6th, where Trump traveled to Georgia to ostensibly campaign for Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, who were in the runoff elections in Georgia for the Senate seats down there. And the speeches that Trump gave, or the speech that Trump gave, was, you know, supposed to be for these candidates. But, you know, he spent the whole time whining about the stolen election and talking about the rally on January 6th and how great it was going to be. And, you know, he's just characterologically unable to really talk about anybody else other than himself. So I don't know if it's like a strategy, or if it's him just not really caring, or if that's just who he is as a person. He's not really capable of, you know, of kind of doing anything else. But, you know, it's kind of a perfect storm in that way, because not only is Trump unable to kind of promote these candidates, but they're also, as you kind of alluded to it and mentioned earlier, they're terrible candidates. I mean, whether you're talking about Paxton or Mike Collins, you know, Husted, this is not exactly a great lineup of speakers. So, you know, I think, you know, Vance, you know, headlining the first night, and Trump headlining the second night, you know, and Vance, you know, he's certainly not a great speaker, but he can at least deliver kind of a normal political speech. And I'm sure Trump will do one of his, you know, rally events. But, you know, I'll be closely watching to see kind of what the room looks like in terms of, are there a lot of empty seats? Is it a really small room? And then it'll be interesting, of course, to monitor what the ratings are and if people actually, you know, care about this at all. And, you know, I guess to kind of segue, how often do you see Canada coming up at this event? You think this will be something that Trump talks about in his own speech and everybody else kind of ignores it? Or has this become like enough of an article of faith now among Republicans where they're going to feel obligated to at least kind of pay lip service to Trump's new trade war with Mark Carney in Canada?
Yeah, I don't think that there are very many Republicans who want to bring it up. Like, yeah, if they get asked the question, they're going to say, you know, I support the president, he's standing up for America, whatever. But nobody thinks that this is like a great issue for Republicans. First of all, they lost the tariff argument. And a lot of them didn't even want to make the argument in the first place. You know, Trump came into office, he tries to sell these tariffs, it goes over like a lead balloon, the public is not into it. Everybody knows what those polls look like. And so Republicans wish that they would just kind of go away as an issue. And then, you know, they did kind of go away. You had the Supreme Court decision that struck down most of them. And I think a lot of people probably in the Republican Party thought, okay, like, let's just talk about something else. Like, people don't like them. Whatever the consequences of that decision are, with the refunds and the lower tax revenue, whatever. Let's just move on. And now, then Trump comes along and just out of nowhere, pretty much, starts this new trade war with Canada. And the thing is, people like Canada. Like, nobody has like ill feelings toward Canada. Trump seems to be the only one. I went back and looked the other day. Canada gets like 80 to 90% approval rating, favorability ratings from Americans. Like, they're nice folks up there. We have, you know, a very symbiotic relationship with them economically and security, and we have for a long time. Nobody is like, God, we really just got to stick it to those goddamn Canadians. Nobody thinks that.
Yeah.
And you also have places where the tariffs are going to hit that have a lot of key races in them, in Maine and Michigan. And the Canadian government is targeting its retaliatory tariffs to products that come from those states. They're looking at the American political situation and saying, okay, where can we impose some pain that is going to actually, you know, actually have a political impact? Trump doesn't think about that. It's his, you know, his thoughts about what to tariff and when to tariff are just kind of random. And so he doesn't really have any understanding of Canadian politics, because if he did, he would know that everything he's doing and saying is designed to make Canadians want to dig in and improve Mark Carney's popularity. Donald Trump is the best friend politically that Mark Carney ever had.
Yeah.
But Canadians have a good understanding of American politics, and so they're trying to, you know, press on those levers wherever they can. And so there isn't a lot in it for a Republican candidate for Senate or House to just go out and be like, you know, these tariffs are fantastic. This new trade war, it is going to be great. Nobody really thinks that. And it also becomes a representation of everything else that's going bad with the economy. Because once of sort of the sort of underlying themes of Trump's economic stewardship is that he's done a lot of crazy stuff that has been counterproductive. And so the tariffs didn't help anybody. The Iran war raised gas prices. And, you know, when you remind people of his kind of erratic policy choices, that's not going to help you make the argument that, like, the status quo is great and let's not have too much change.
Yeah, I will note on the thing you said earlier about how, you know, no one wants to fight Canada. I think probably that is true. I mean, there was a YouGov America poll this week that showed that an all-time high of 38% of Republicans now view Canada as either an enemy or a threat, I think was the phrasing that they used. So that did, you know, jumped out to me where, like, he still has that power among kind of the hardcore base. And that's even a little bit higher percentage than I would kind of think, even just, you know, with the caveat that they're just polling Republicans, that, you know, that's some significant movement of people, you know, because Trump doesn't even really make a coherent case against Canada. It's just kind of like they've been ripping us off for decades. They took all of our jobs. And it's like there's no actual anecdotal or, you know, so there's no anecdotes or data to kind of back that up. It's just all vibes. But, you know, even with that being the case, it's enough to sway, you know, at least a sizable contingent of Republican voters. And so it's something to kind of keep an eye on, you know, if we go further down this road. And of course, Trump today on Truth Social, I think kind of went the furthest that he's gone, saying, you know, wait until Canada's economy blows up, basically, you know, sort of taunting Mark Carney and threatening, you know, economic ruin in Canada, you know, which seemed like a pretty major escalation and doesn't really indicate to me that there's an off-ramp coming up anytime soon. So, you know, something to monitor there. I do want to get to this question that Billy puts, which kind of touches upon some of this. Billy wrote, are you concerned Trump does not appear to care about the midterms because his plan is to interfere and cheat to rig results? Paul, I'm curious for your thoughts. You know, we had a piece in Public Notice this week from Liz Dye, who, you know, is a brilliant legal correspondent, talking about the post office's rule for mail ballots and how, you know, the Supreme Court, if they do get involved, which it seems like, you know, maybe they will, to sort of uphold that rule, that it could lead to, you know, huge chaos where, you know, the rule would basically be such that they have a list of voters that can vote by mail based on the voter rolls that they are trying to compel states to turn over to the federal government. And if, you know, in a batch of ballots, even one mail ballot comes from someone who's not on that list, they can throw out like the entire batch and voters wouldn't necessarily be notified of this. So it's not clear that there'd be any sort of process even to challenge this. Now, the legal challenges are ongoing. It's unclear to what extent this will be operative by November, but, you know, that's one way in which, you know, the results could be kind of tampered with in a way, or the result could be rigged in a sense. So what's your level of concern about that? And do you think that that informs some of what we're seeing from Trump, where he seems, you know, kind of like aggressively disinterested in how these races are going?
Yeah, I think the two things may actually be separate. Like, I think you can tell that he's sort of torn, that he knows it will be bad for him if Democrats win a big victory and take control of one of both houses. But he also wants to distance himself from the whole thing, to tell people, you know, it's not my fault. I'm not on the ballot. But he says, you know, I'm not on the ballot, but act like I'm on the ballot. He doesn't want it to be seen as a repudiation of him. And he doesn't really care about legislating, so that doesn't matter to him. But at the same time, you know, I would say that my level of concern on the postal stuff is growing. I have changed in the last few days about how worried I am. At first, I was like, okay, well, you know, he issued this crazy executive order. And the Postal Service, the first things it said were, you know, we'll, you know, basically like we'll comply with the law, we'll wait to see. And also just it's so plain on its face that it's unconstitutional, A, for the president to dictate what ballots count and which ones don't, and B, for the Postal Service to decide whose ballots count and whose ballots don't. Like, both of those things, it ought to be a 9-0 decision on the Supreme Court. But what we've seen in the last few days, you know, we had this whistleblower report that Senator Richard Blumenthal released that showed that the Postal Service is in fact going ahead as though this year they're going to be implementing Trump's executive order. And potentially disenfranchising millions, if not tens of millions of people. And despite the fact that the lists that they're gathering are just absolutely going to be riddled with errors, and they have rules apparently, like if one ballot scans incorrectly, then they're going to set aside, basically throw out the whole bunch, which could be thousands and thousands of people who don't get their ballots counted, because they're going to like send them back to the Board of Elections, and it'll end up being too late. And so on the one hand, you have the Postal Service doing these things that seem to indicate that they are just moving ahead as though this is going to be all fine and they're going to do this, even though it is that not only that they don't have the legal right, and the way they're executing it is just utterly incompetent, because it starts with the incompetence of the Trump administration. But that's one side, is what the Postal Service is doing. And then on the other side, you know, the question of, is the Supreme Court going to let this happen? I find it impossible to have any confidence in that. Like, if you go back and you read their order that they put out the other day, that basically lifted one stay and there's another stay, it didn't have a lot of immediate legal effect. But in the text of it, the majority starts off by saying something like, you know, the administration is doing this because of their concern for the integrity of elections. And like, that just jumped out at me. Yeah. And I was like, wait a second. Like, are they seriously willing to grant that even now? And, you know, the other thing about it is ballots are going to start to go out within days. And there's this thing that the Supreme Court invented called the Purcell Principle, which says that you can't make changes to voting procedures too close to an election. They didn't define what too close is, but they basically said, like, and that's perfectly reasonable. You know, a state shouldn't be able to just like change its maps 3 days before the election or whatever, because it causes voter confusion. Nobody knows what they're doing, et cetera. But in practice, what they have done is they've applied this principle in basically the same way that they do everything else, which is that if it helps Democrats, then they strike it down. And if it helps Republicans, then they uphold it. And so they have, I think it was in the Alabama case, where they basically said that to not change the maps too close to an election would be a violation of the Purcell principle, even though, you know, like, that's absolutely upside down. Like, basically, we know how this court handles voting questions, and it's just simple and straightforward. They're going to do whatever is necessary to help Republicans win. And even though we don't have any specific indication yet that they are like all gung-ho on the substantive question of this, of these changes to the postal regulations that are going to disenfranchise millions of people, like, I have a hard time convincing myself that, oh, you know, in the end, there are going to be two Republican votes in addition to the three Democratic votes on the court to actually do the right thing. Now, maybe, you know, who knows? But I have to say, I am getting more worried as time goes on.
Yeah, Liz's piece left me more concerned as well. I mean, I do kind of have the thought of, you know, is there a chance that this could kind of backfire on Republicans in a way where, you know, Democrats are obviously going to be highly motivated to vote. Now, there are some states, and I saw someone in the comments here mention that they live in Oregon, which is basically an all-male state, which would, you know, be obviously, you know, especially affected by this. But, you know, I think Blumenthal and some of his, he was on TV the other day kind of making this case that he basically came out and said that he's not really trusting male voting this time around. He was encouraging people, you know, to help others who might not be able to get to the polls physically to go vote, you know, in person if they can. So, you know, I just kind of wonder if it's like one of these deals where, because Democrats are so much more motivated to vote, you know, I could at least kind of imagine a world where this ends up, you know, kind of suppressing Republican votes in the sense that, you know, they're not going to have the same level of commitment to getting out there and voting. Now, you know, I guess this was kind of the same calculation that Trump made in 2020, where that was a different context because COVID was going on. But the whole, you know, the stage that he set for the big lie, a big assumption there was that, you know, the initial in-person votes would help him. And then, you know, if he was ahead on election night, he'd kind of declare victory. And then, you know, try to say that all the subsequent votes that were counted that were submitted by mail were invalid, or, you know, kind of rigged against him in some way. We don't have that same incentive this time. There's no pandemic going on that'll keep people away from voting. So, I don't know. Any thoughts on that? I just kind of wonder if this is maybe a little bit, you know, too smart, that, you know, throwing the system into chaos, which really would encourage people to go vote in person because Democrats are more motivated, might be something that actually hurts Republicans.
I think that is possible, that it will only increase an already motivated Democratic base to make sure they get to the polls. But the question is how much, you know, like, does that add a point or two or three or four to their numbers? And then how many votes, if this stuff is actually implemented, are going to be threatened? It's hard to know how big the magnitude is of either side of that equation and which one is going to be bigger. So I don't know. I mean, I do think it'll probably motivate a lot of people to vote, but I'm still really worried about what happens if the Postal Service starts just en masse, not allowing, you know, entire states to submit their mail ballots or knocking out thousands and thousands of ballots. I think we should still be worried.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of the Supreme Court and, you know, obviously the damage that they're doing just to the functioning of our institutions and voting, I know your most recent piece, unless I missed one today, that you might have posted since I was catching up on all of your excellent writing this morning, was on James Clyburn on, I believe it was Meet the Press. It was one of the Sunday shows over the weekend. Of course, Clyburn being a South Carolina representative, known as kind of being a moderate, sort of at the middle of the party. And this interview is notable because he came out very unequivocally and said that he supports Supreme Court reform. I think he threw out 13 justices being the number that he would prefer. You know, there's different suggestions for kind of expanding the court, but your whole piece was sort of unpacking the significance of that. So give us kind of the thumbnail case of why you thought that particular remark from Clyburn was so notable.
Yeah, so Clyburn is about as establishment gets. You know, he's been in Congress for three decades. He was the third ranking person in the leadership under Nancy Pelosi. And so I think it's significant when he comes out and says, yes, we should have 13 justices. It's not some crazy lefty saying this. And I think what it tells us is that this question of Supreme Court reform writ large is becoming basically table stakes for any 2028 contender, that they have to deal with this. Now, they don't all have to support court expansion. There's a few different things kind of on the menu. One of them is expanding the court. One of them is term limits for justices. And then there are some others about, strength and ethics rules and stuff like that. So I went and I looked to see what every potential 2028 contender had said. And they're the ones who have said that yes, we should expand the court. Let's see if I can remember. It was Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ruben Gallego. And that's actually kind of an ideologically diverse group, Gallego and Buttigieg and Harris. They're not like the leftmost people. Mm-hmm. And then you've got a whole bunch of people who have basically said, yes, we should have term limits. And then there's another group who are people who haven't yet taken a position on anything, but are saying like everything should be on the table. So, you know, that's people like Josh Shapiro and I think Andy Beshear may have said something like that. J.B. Pritzker said something like that.
Yeah.
They're basically just saying like we're going to have some kind of reform. I'm not going to say yet what I want it to be, but we're going to have this discussion. And I think it is going to be a big topic of debate. There's going to be a few things like that. Like if people may remember in 2020, you know, there was this big, like, who are we as Democrats debate in the presidential primaries. A lot of it revolved around healthcare. We had this long discussion about, do you support single payer or do you support something less than single payer? And it was very, you know, intense and at times even angry. And none of it made any difference because Joe Biden got elected and he had actually what was a pretty progressive healthcare plan, although it was not single payer. It involved a sort of a Medicaid buy-in kind of thing. And he never did a thing about it. Basically just like put it in a file cabinet. It went nowhere.
Yeah.
So those things, you can have a very intense debate in the campaign and then it just disappears. But for whatever that's worth, right now, I think it really looks like that's going to be something that if you want to be serious in 2020, you're going to have to say, I want Supreme Court reform in some fashion. And, not everybody is going to say that they want to expand the court. And there's reasonable arguments against it, I guess, but that is something that I think is really going to be a hotly debated topic.
To your knowledge, has there been polling generally about expanding the court? And I ask because, you know, at the same time as we're talking this week about Clyburn's comments and, how there's been a shift, you know, within the Democratic Party in terms of broad embrace of court reform, you know, Republicans in the House were pushing this vote on a constitutional amendment, which would set the number of justices at 9. I don't think it went anywhere because then they attached that with another poison pill, which I think was like the SAVE Act. So it ended up being kind of this this mash together. But Republicans were hitting at least the right wing channels and really, you know, making a big deal out of this that they couldn't understand why a Democrat wouldn't want to support 9 justices if they don't support packing the court. So I just wonder if it's an issue that plays well within the Democratic coalition. But then I wonder, you know, when it gets to a general election context, if there's enough support for that to be something that whoever wins the primary would actually campaign on. So, it's possible. I'm just not aware. Have you seen any polling that would indicate one way or the other what the status of that is?
Yeah, there hasn't been very much. But what I've seen says that term limits get really, really high support. Expanding the court, much less so. But here's the thing about that. Right now, up until now, this has been just kind of an elite discussion. Most people are not even aware of these proposals. And this actually relates back to what we were talking about Canada, when you mentioned that you saw a poll showing that now some more substantial number, like 38% of Republicans say they have a bad view of Canada. The thing about that is, shout out to my poli science majors, you may remember John Zoller, The Nature and Origins of Mass Opinion. One of the things that he found and other political scientists have found is that voters really take their cues from the elites in their own party. And when everybody, all the elites in their party have one position, then the voters are like, okay, that's what the Democratic position is, or that's what the Republican position is. So that's what I think. When it changes, the voters will eventually follow suit. And so it's not surprising that there's been a bunch of anti-Canada rhetoric from the president, who's the leader of the Republican Party, and there's a certain number of Republican voters are like, yeah, screw those Canadians. And I think that once you have this debate that about the Supreme Court that is taking place among Democrats, not just like, you know, in the corners of Blue Sky and in these places where you have like, you know, kind of like just the political junkies who are really tuned into it. But if that really becomes a big thing in the primaries, I think you will start to see the voters come along, and where they actually follow on which reform they like, that is a little less certain. But the voters will, I think, follow the leaders in their party. And you know, yes, I think the existing positive feelings toward term limits are because people have thought about that in relationship to legislatures before. And term limits are very popular. I think they're not a good idea for legislators. But that's a whole separate issue. But it's something that, like, it makes a lot of intuitive sense. Like, why should they be able to serve forever? It's kind of an anti-establishment thing. Like, you know, yeah, they're all bums, throw them out. We have to work a little harder to make a case for expanding the court, especially because there's a very intuitive argument that, like, well, if Democrats do it, Republicans will just do it again. So it gets a little more complicated. But and that may mean that term limits is where all the Democrats end up settling, because it's a much easier sell to voters. But I think you're going to see, as people tune into that debate, if it's being made by presidential candidates, then their opinions may shift.
Yeah, well, I look forward to us having those debates, because that means that we'll be through the midterms and hopefully with a good result for Democrats, and hopefully with Trump being a full lame duck at that point. So whatever, 2 months away, I think almost to the day now. So leave it there for this week. Next week, I'm sure we'll have some Trumpapalooza recaps to talk about, or some takes that we can share after at least I'm planning to kind of clear the decks and watch both nights of that. And if you enjoyed our discussion today, I mean, we pretty much went through a week in the cross section, because I think every topic that we discussed was a subject of one of Paul's excellent feature stories on his Substack. So if you enjoyed our conversation, please sign up for a paid subscription to the cross section, and please sign up for public notice as well. I'll be celebrating the 5-year anniversary of rolling public notice out in just a few weeks. So I have some content kind of planned surrounding that, but it's a big milestone. So your support is appreciated. Paul, as always, thanks for your time. Hope you enjoy watching Trumpapalooza if you do tune in, or are you just going to watch my clips like you usually do?
Maybe a little of both. I don't think I can take the whole thing from start to finish, but I'll try to not just rely on you. I know it's a lot of pressure that we all put on you to distill everything. So.
Yeah, well, and as you mentioned, because it didn't quite click until I read your piece that the NFL is starting, and I'm an NFL fan, so I might have to at least have like the 2-monitor deal going, because I'm gonna want to watch what, you know, like most of America, I'm gonna want to watch those NFL games more than JD Vance or Trump. So I do wonder if that'll come backfire.
TiVo.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So in any event, thanks to the nearly 900 a day, it's kind of a different sort of week with Labor Day looming. I'm sure people aren't as locked in on the news as they might otherwise be. But enjoy the last weekend of summer. We will see you next week, and we will be back next week on Friday, not Thursday. So finally back in our normal time. We'll leave it for today. Paul, thanks again. Talk to you next week.